Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have a very large audience today. Keep sending that invitation to your friends. So let me introduce the JPC and our work, and then our speaker. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policy by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can sign up for our articles published under the heading of Insight. You can see our quarterly magazine, In Focus, as well as our blog, In Context, all on our website, www.jewishpolicycenter.org. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity, those being really hot button topics these days. This webinar series has been an effort to bring you not only the latest thinking in those areas, but also to bring you some of the backstory, some of the understory, and some of the story that hasn't emerged yet. We've had Israeli Brigadier General Asaf Orion on the changes currently happening in U.S.-Israel security cooperation as regards each country's relations with China. Jonathan Shanzer on what's happening or what's blowing up in Iran. Colonel David Maxwell on North Korea. Claudia Rosette on Hong Kong. The almost application of Israeli sovereignty over Judea and Samaria with Arsen Ostrovsky. We've had Douglas Feith, Harold Rode, Michael Duran, and Brigadier General Yossi Kuperwasser, among others. As regards the Wuhan virus, I know it's COVID-19, but to us, it's still the Wuhan virus. We've also tried to shift people's thinking from the health aspects of the pandemic to its impact on internal and foreign policy choices for America's friends and America's adversaries, like China. So it's my pleasure to have back today Dan Blumenthal, Director of Asian Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Dan has both served in and advised the U.S. government on China for over a decade. He was senior director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia at DOD, and a commissioner on the congressionally mandated U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, where he held the position of vice chairman. And he's been a visiting professor at the U.S. Naval War College. His work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, foreign policy, the national interest, and most important from our provincial point of view. Dan has written for us here at the JPC in our quarterly magazine, In Focus, most recently in our summer 2020 issue. Check out his article, China Censorship, Propaganda, and Disinformation on our website. And most importantly for the moment, Dan has a book coming out in November, The China Nightmare, The Grand Ambitions of a Decaying State. According to the blurb I have, this book is about, contrary to an emerging bipartisan and global consensus, China is not the global superpower Xi Jinping's government would have the world believe. Indeed, a still powerful China is in decay and beset by internal and geopolitical challenges that will frustrate the nation's grand ambitions. The book was called Thought-Provoking and Counterintuitive. I love counterintuitive. I'm ordering the book. You should order a book, and I hope we'll get a little bit of a preview of it today when Dan speaks to us. Let me remind you, we welcome your questions, but your microphones are not on. Send your questions to our info email, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. And now, Dan, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Shoshana. Thank you for that nice introduction and the nice plug of the upcoming book, November 17th, that I've been working on for too many years, more years than I care to admit in terms of the research evolution and so forth. And thanks for the great work of the Jewish Policy Center as well. I think it might also be interesting to, your introduction reminded me that it might be interesting for many of the people calling in or joining today that I have a article in the Jewish Review of Books that just came out on Israel and China, but this one points more to the risks of the risks of internal Chinese espionage against Israeli technology and internal attempts to influence Chinese Israeli politics if there's just too much tech investment by China into Israel. But we can go into that in more detail if people like to. As promised, I will give a preview of the book because I think some of the arguments are very timely. So the counterintuitive part, I think, is that China is not 10 feet tall and growing to 12 feet tall, but yet it still poses many, many problems for the United States. And in fact, the very fact that it went from, let's say, 0 feet tall, to stick with this metaphor, to 6 feet tall, let's say, in an unbelievably short span of time, but is kind of stuck and stagnant at that level is making it more dangerous, in fact. And a lot of the lashing out we've seen recently, I think, has to do with the fact that Chinese leaders know that there's not just economic slower growth and stagnation, but huge internal problems that they need to distract the public from. So let me start on, you know, the China is very powerful side of the argument. China is very powerful. There is no question. It is the most powerful and complicated strategic competitor, strategic rival the United States has ever faced, bar none. And I say that to include the Soviet Union. And what I mean by that is China is more, even with its problems, is more dynamic, more economically grew faster, has a bigger economy, and is more intertwined in global economic affairs, much more difficult to contain, much more difficult to decouple with economically and technologically, much more difficult to keep certain technologies out of its hands than was the Soviet Union. Much more complicated problem. And on top of all that, the United States and China still cooperate on many issues, particularly in the commercial arena. So more complicated rival than there's always going to be some element of diplomatic and economic engagement with China led by the Chinese Communist Party, even as we compete and defend ourselves from the most malignant aspects of Chinese foreign policy. So China is powerful. It's as I just explained, in terms of its economic growth and wealth. It has a very formidable military. It has challenging U.S. defense and military strategy in East Asia. U.S. military and defense strategy in East Asia since the end of World War II has been to rely on a set of alliances, the U.S.-Japan alliance, U.S.-South Korea alliance, close partnership with Taiwan, U.S.-Australia alliance, Philippines, Thailand, and then increasingly a number of Southeast Asian countries, and to put a decent amount of U.S. military power forward outside the U.S. homeland into Japan, South Korea, and other places. China has worked steadily since the 1990s studying the U.S. military, and neutralizing many U.S. advantages. And in fact, the big fear at the Department of Defense is that if we don't speed up our military modernization and reposturing, we could in fact lose a war to China. War is unthinkable in many ways, but people do have to think about it. And the very fact that we're in that situation means geopolitically, China has a psychological advantage in East Asia. It can and is coercing countries more to do its bidding and attempting to undermine the U.S.-led open and free order in favor of a Chinese more authoritarian order, more favorable to an authoritarian government like China's. So the competition is underway, both in terms of military competition. U.S. still trying to deter Chinese actions, China increasingly using its military and quasi-military forces to further its territorial and other ambitions in and around its periphery. So it's powerful. It's technologically dynamic. The reason you're hearing these days so much about a so-called tech war, which I think is a bit of a sloppy terminology, but there certainly is a competition for emerging technologies that have military applications. There's a competition for technologies that, like telecommunications, 5G, that have implications for people's, including the United States and other free countries, data privacy, cybersecurity, and so forth. Since COVID-19, we've seen also just that we don't want to rely on a medical supply chain, technologically and otherwise, that is so much of which is based in production is based in China. So there is certainly a rethink, a big rethink on the United States part about technology, about technology relations, about what to keep out of China's hands, about how to reshape some of the global supply chains and other things that have moved so much production into China. As you can see, if you read the news every day, these are extremely difficult problems, not easy to do. And that goes back to this question of China's enmeshment, and it's a deep, deep enmeshment, advantaged by globalization and so forth in the world economy. So these are problems and issues that we're going to face for many, many years to come. What's the proper role of commercial relations and technological relations with a strategic rival? Questions we never have had to ask before. Okay, so that's a bit of a preview on the strength side. There's more on the strength side of the ledger. The Chinese are actively reshaping international institutions, as we've seen with the WHO, picking their own people to run it, UN Human Rights Council, other international institutions we tend to pay less attention to. China pays a lot of attention to them and is trying to reshape those institutions to align more with their own strategies and goals. Okay, but the counterintuitive part is China's also weak and in some ways getting weaker. So what do I mean? What do I mean by decay? Well, let's just go through a few different aspects. So first, as I mentioned before, the economy, while still growing, the GDP is still growing. We don't ever know how much because the Premier Li Keqiang said in a fit of honesty, he said, statistics in China are man-made. I mean, they're man-made. We can't trust them. The Chinese official statistics are that it stopped growing at 8 or 9% per year a couple of years ago, 3-4 years ago, and grows at 6% per year. It's probably less than that. It's probably, 4-3%. And this year, obviously, with the pandemic, much lower than that. Still, would be the envy of Europe and the United States in terms of those levels of growth, but it's not. It's still a very poor country. It's still a very poor country. This is critical to understand. It is not a wealthy country. If you go by per capita basis of GDP or net national wealth counts that the Federal Reserve does, it's a poor country. And that leads to another point about Chinese possible stagnation and weaknesses, and that is it's a poor country that's getting old very quickly, very big demographic problems. So in 2030, its demographics will look like Europe. And let me just say that again for emphasis, because I think this is well misunderstood. In 2030, China's demographics will look like Europe, which means it'll be old. It won't have enough workers to replace retirees. But it's old before it has the money to do anything about it. So Japan and Europe are getting old, even Japan's shrinking in population size, but its payouts in terms of its pension and social security system is very, very high because it's wealthy per capita. China doesn't have that. The Chinese social security system was the Chinese family, the Chinese children, but it doesn't have enough children to take care of a family of grandparents. And it's well underfunded, any pension system and so on. And the numbers in terms of old age are staggering. So just staggering, given the scale of China. Well, it's sort of an old age tsunami is coming to China with people who also won't be well taken care of. So that is a very, that is a big tailwind in terms of China's growth and grand ambitions. Another problem that China faces is that the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping certainly looks very strong. And Xi Jinping certainly has crushed all dissent and gone on these Maoist-like campaigns and purges against any perceived enemies or rivals. But that has created big problems in the system in terms of its functioning, as we saw with respect to turning that local epidemic in Wuhan into this global pandemic. And what I mean by that is nobody in the localities in China wants to act decisively before consulting with Xi Jinping and his lieutenants back in Beijing. So there was no lockdown in Wuhan, for example, until the Beijing authorities decided there would be. But by then it was far too late in terms of the amount of people who left Wuhan and infected the rest of the world. So that's no way to run a country of that size. It's just not possible. And so some of the basic functionings of the government have been paralyzed by Xi Jinping's much more totalitarian impulses. So I think, again, that points to not political growth, or it's political atrophy. And I think Xi Jinping has done that, has reshaped the authoritarian politics of China and the Chinese Communist Party, because he was so afraid that there would be a split in the party ranks. In 2012, there was a contest for the, a very scary from the CCP's point of view, contest for the head of China, and he won it. Xi Jinping won that contest, but I think CCP leaders are spooked by their analysis of what happened in Soviet Russia with Gorbachev, and they are trying to guard against any splits in the leadership, too fast reforms and so on. But this is causing real fractures and fights within. And I think that leads to the next point, which is because of these, every time you see a real political problem in China, you see international external lashing out. So during COVID-19, one might have expected China to focus internally, focus on health, public health problems, focus on economic growth, other social problems. But during COVID-19, while some of that was done, China was very aggressive on the international stage. It was aggressive in the South China Sea in terms of really interfering with Vietnamese and Filipino fishing boats. It was aggressive in the Taiwan Strait in terms of its muscular exercises and intimidation campaigns. It, of course, as we know, was very aggressive in Hong Kong in terms of doing away with any fiction even of one country, two systems, the policies that allowed Hong Kong some autonomy. It's aggressive in India. It started skirmishes on the Indian border, and it was very aggressive in terms of its public diplomacy, disinformation and information campaigns targeted at the United States, targeted at Europe, targeted at Australia. And I think we're going to see more of this as China feels besieged from within and without. I think we're going to see more externalization of these problems as Xi Jinping tries to whip up some legitimacy based on nationalist credentials and credentials that he's successfully standing up to the United States and to the rest of the world. So it's the strength and weakness, I argue, in the China nightmare, this combination of strength and weakness that is the nightmare scenario, actually, because it's strong enough to cause problems and project power, but weak in the sense of its governance capability, weak in the sense of its own legitimacy. And that historically has been a very scary combination. I'll stop by saying this. It's important to recall that it wasn't the problem with the most dangerous times in the U.S.-Soviet Cold War competition were not, in fact, when the Soviets thought that they're ascendant, although perhaps they felt they were ascendant in certain military capabilities and strategic nuclear capabilities. Nor was it the fact that Nazi Germany felt it was ascendant compared to the UK or other countries. Maybe they thought the other countries were weak, but in terms of economic strength and so on. It wasn't the feeling of a sentence. Same thing with Imperial Japan before it attacked the United States. In many of these cases, it was the fact that they're strong enough to lock in gains, but the window was closing for them. And I fear that that's increasingly where we're going to be with China. And so it's going to be more urgent to have really strong deterrent policies on the military front, really strong diplomacy with our allies and new partners, and to continue right now on a policy that's been changed in the last few years from just sheer engaging China and hoping for the best in some ways, although that's a little unfair, to a more confrontational approach that tries to stop China's gains and stop its momentum. So anyway, I think that's where we are with China. I think the U.S. is basically on the right path in terms of its new attitude, new approach to China. U.S. obviously has very big problems of its own, including whether we can sustain a strategy of competition and deterrence and defense. But anyway, I think there's probably a lot of questions and answers. Let me stop there and not give away the entire book either. Thank you very much. And I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Dan. We do have a lot of questions. I've been trying to group them into economic and security things, but let's start with big questions or overall questions. As you see it from here, does China really have COVID-19 under control? And how, if they do, how do they manage that? Do they have the same problem with old people in terms of fatalities from COVID-19?
Well, the thank you for the question. The difference, first of all, I think the answer is we don't know, because the information they've been giving out about numbers of infections was at first false, demonstrably. I mean, it wasn't possible to have that low an infection rate if you looked at the countries that did really good testing early on, like South Korea, and you compared population size and so forth to China, even in Wuhan. The Chinese numbers they were giving out were probably off by a factor of 30 or 40, a huge magnitude. And also the infection rate of when people weren't tested and they left Wuhan by plane and so forth was much higher than was reported. So the first answer is we don't know. Infection rate and death rate is probably much higher than is being reported. But the second answer, I guess, is that authoritarian China can get things under control by completely forcibly locking people into their homes, which they've done. And having mandates on various mask wearing and so forth that they can enforce extremely strictly under penalty of jail and disappearance. So to the extent things do look a little bit better and the economy in certain places is finding its way again, it's because of extremely harsh measures the Chinese have undertook since the embarrassment of January to lock people down. Again, reporting on bad news is not done in China. So in terms of elderly fatality rates and mortality rates, but you know, we have to assume it's similar, but we don't have the numbers. That's the hardest things about China in terms of calculating anything, including the economy, is we just don't have good numbers.
Okay. So we talk about restructuring and we talk about economic issues. Is there a domestic U.S.-China lobby, including business leaders, academics, journalists, so on and so forth, in either party that opposes American sanctions or other measures against Xi and the Chinese Communist Party?
Absolutely. And so it's built in. China doesn't even need to pay for it. And some of it is even that nefarious. It's just U.S. businesses who follow the U.S. engagement policy, did what they were told in a sense and found big business opportunities in China and are now so dependent on their China operations, operations for manufacturing in complex value chains, somewhat the consumer market in China, but not as big as people think. But they're just so dependent on revenue in certain industries, revenue based, you know, selling to certain state owned enterprises. You know, and so there's a built in, even if you don't want to call it lobbying on behalf of China, there's a built in powerful sector that says we shouldn't change anything because it's going to hurt our economy. And that definitely has an effect on our policy without question. I mean, at the top of our government right now, they still battle it out between those who are looking after commercial interests and those who are looking after national security interests. And although the national security interests are gaining the upper hand for now.
So let me ask a multi-part question. I'm going to group some things together here. Is it possible then, in your view, to restructure the supply chain, at least in vital areas such as medicine and protective equipment? Is it possible to restructure enough to do that? Are we doing that? And would a private sector boycott of Chinese products be useful? There was a time when Americans decided they weren't going to buy Chinese things, and somebody called them General Walmart and General Kmart, you know, the ability of consumers to have an impact on China. Do those things work?
Well, so, yeah. So are we, let me go with the first set of questions. Are we doing enough? Can we reshore? We of course can reshore when it's in our national security interests or public health and safety. I believe on the public health and safety, the medical supply chain, that's so well understood by Americans since COVID-19 that I just think that's going to happen. I mean, even if costs for consumers will go up, it may take time, but that's something that people understand viscerally is that there were shortages of masks and other equipment because China nationalized companies and refused to export them. So I think that's just, it's a matter of time before that. And pharmaceutical generics and so forth, I think will be next. You know, again, expensive, it'll be more expensive, but I just think that's a cost, I believe, that the United States and the consumers will pay, particularly if politicians level with them and say, you know, the consumption costs will go up. On some of the things that we care about in the national security world, like advanced semiconductor chips and other things that can go towards military advantage in China, it's harder for consumers or people not directly focused on these topics to understand. We're starting to export controls are much stricter now than they were a couple of years ago. Companies are looking to how to reshore or find other revenue that was based in China, but it's taking time. It's a messy process. I think we're seeing stories about it every day. In terms of consumer boycotts, I think obviously it's tough though, because so much is produced in China. I mean, or content is produced in China, or, you know, even if your iPhone isn't really produced in China, it's assembled in China. So, without a national policy that really leaves the things that are the least threatening to us, and really decides that when it comes to advanced high tech, designs and so on, we're not exporting that to China for any possible end use that could hurt our national security. I think consumer boycotts would be very difficult absent that.
Thank you. Moving into the security sphere more directly, do you think that the Chinese, as an ultimate goal, seek dominance over Japan, or is the goal Taiwan? And how likely do you think an open conflict could be, either by miscalculation or, as you pointed out earlier, China feeling that it needs to consolidate something now?
Well, they certainly want to. They want Taiwan to be a province of China, and that is the area geopolitically, geographically, that is the riskiest between the U.S. and China, because we don't have an alliance with Taiwan, but we have both a moral and security commitment to Taiwan. And but China is not, there's no give on their policy of unification with Taiwan. The only thing stopping it is Taiwan's own efforts and our support of Taiwan. Japan, I think they want to subjugate Japan. I think they want Japan to essentially be a vassal state of China. I think their strategy there is to undermine Japanese confidence in the U.S.-Japan alliance and essentially say to the Japanese that the U.S. doesn't have the staying power or the interest to remain in the Asia-Pacific, and just have Japan cut a deal that would give up a lot of their autonomy and foreign policy. There's a lot of hatred of Japan, a lot of manufactured hatred of Japan. And so I think Japan is definitely feels as threatened by China as does Taiwan. In terms of conflict, you know, the conflict with China is, you know, conflict with China is so difficult to get your head around because we have two countries that are nuclear powers, cyber powers, you know, powers that can do enormous damage, not to one another, but to the world economy. But of course, one has to prepare for it and one has to understand how to prepare for it in order to deter conflict. I mean, the number one thing the United States and its allies need to be doing is to remove any idea from China that it could win any pathway to a victory in terms of its political objectives. And there is a lot more work to be done in that respect. I don't think the Chinese yet think they're ready to risk a conflict over Taiwan, but any number of things could happen, including what I pointed to in terms of a crisis, a political crisis that's more acute, a feeling of confidence, a feeling of U.S. distraction that could be actually a very big miscalculation in the sense that China attacks Taiwan and thinks the United States isn't going to do anything about it. And that is something to worry about.
So that goes to a question a listener has sent in. How can the United States maintain its political credibility vis-a-vis China when we have societal problems, we have race relations problems, we have poverty problems, and we've fallen behind them in many areas critical to modern life, healthcare, infrastructure? How do you tell the Japanese or the Taiwanese or the Filipinos, yeah, we're there for you, we're going to be strong for you? How do we do that?
Well, there's no question that not only China, but Russia are benefiting greatly from our divisions and exploiting them. Without question, and our divisions are becoming a national security problem, there's no question about that. Now that said, you know, we have faced up to the Soviets before and other powers when we were deeply divided as a country, obviously 1968-69. Post-Vietnam War plus racial problems and so on. It didn't stop us from continuing, with our grand strategy of containing the Soviets. Obviously, it hurt us. It hurt us in terms of moving to a policy for a period of time that accepted our own decline and tried to find ways to negotiate a new arrangement to kind of manage our decline before we turned around again and you know, we're confident and able to pick ourselves up. These are big problems. I mean, there's no question. I will say on the healthcare systems, and I will say on the social systems, we obviously have many problems in the United States, but I think all of us and almost everyone we know in China would rather live under our system still with all its problems than China's. And even with the pandemic and so forth, you know, the minute we lift travel bans and so forth, I think you'll still see Chinese flocking to the United States for a whole host of reasons.
I'd rather live here too. Listener asks, would you please expound on the China-Israel tech question?
Yeah, absolutely. So so I don't, you know, in this piece that just came out, I don't see, I looked very carefully at the statistics and I didn't see the same today, the same massive investments in Israeli technology that some others have seen. The biggest Chinese investments in Israel have been, oddly enough, in the entertainment sector. There was a massive investment in a video game company and in some other sectors. There certainly are tech investments, without question. And China is very interested in acquiring technology from Israel. And of course, developing a commercial foothold in a country like Israel is sometimes a Trojan horse for then demanding more technology afterwards. My point, though, is Israel's very small and can't withstand the pressures that China can put on countries. So I urged people to take a look at what happened in Australia recently. So Australia is uncovering these soft political subversion and espionage networks that attempted to change the course of Australian politics, align Australian politics and policy with that of China, and then of course the espionage across universities, across laboratories. Now, we're finding it here in the United States as well, but we're bigger and stronger and more equipped to deal with it. So I think they prey on countries like Israel, actually. And it's very exciting for small countries like Israel to get that kind of attention lavished upon them. And the dollars are good, but it comes with a real cost. And I think that cost is, over time, China asking for things politically that are more and more difficult to deliver.
Thank you. Do you think, question from a listener, do you think that China will consider retaliating against the United States by selling some of their $2 trillion of investment in U.S. treasuries? And if they do, what's the impact?
I don't think they're going to drop the treasury bills. I don't think they're going to drop the bonds because right now it helps their economy as much as it helps our own. I don't know, you know, over the long term, if it really helps our own. I mean, this is how we finance deficits. I mean, this is how we spend more than we take in. But the impact, of course, would be, you know, higher interest rates and so on. Not trivial, but I don't, you know, China needs to buy those treasuries, you know, to do something with its surplus dollars. The reason it has surplus dollars is because it's favoring production and lowering its own currency in order to favor export and production over consumption. So it's structural to their system that they are running these surpluses. And it's something they don't like either because of the U.S. ability to sanction and so forth. But I don't see them. I don't see them in any reasonable time frame dumping U.S. treasuries unless they're prepared to restructure their economy.
Seems unlikely. So you mentioned that if or when the pandemic winds its way down, we're likely to reopen the doors and Chinese people will want to come here again as they did before. Do you foresee the United States government restricting access of Chinese nationals to the United States?
I think in a targeted manner, yes. So I think increased, you know, the U.S. Justice Department started what I think is a very important initiative called the China Initiative, where it is finally letting prosecutors and U.S. attorneys go after, actually enforce the economic crimes and economic espionage and influence crimes on their books. And they've rolled up a good number of Chinese networks that I think many of you have read about, from Harvard to University of Texas, and so forth. I think there'll be a lot of those cases. Those were American citizens who were receiving undisclosed money from China to pass on scientific and technological know-how. I think we'll see over time a targeted restriction and increased vetting, certainly to protect ourselves from espionage and political subversion. But I don't see a wholesale ban or anything like that. I think that too many institutions and the U.S. economy benefits a lot from Chinese nationals looking to study here and work here.
Thank you. Moving on to human rights policy. We had Claudia Rosette talk to us about Hong Kong, which is an amazing program, and Michael Durand, who talked a little bit about the Uyghurs and the Tibetans. So there's a sort of twofold question. Well, maybe it's just one question. What should we do? How can we help them? We have done certain things in terms of Hong Kong. Not clear that we've done anything in terms of the Uyghurs. And the UK yesterday in the UN said it would not oppose China's desire to be on the UN Human Rights Council. How do you get over those things? How do you help the people?
Yeah, it's, I mean, these sorts of things with the UK decision are just mind-boggling, but as anyone who's watched the UN Human Rights Council closely knows, it's just par for the course, but now China's more active in actually trying to gain seats that matter, so, you know, that would block investigations and so forth of the kind we've done successfully, the UN has done successfully with respect to North Korea. So, you know, those sorts of things are mind-boggling. I mean, just getting the West, you know, to do things on the Uyghurs, including condemnations and, you know, and those sorts of things do matter to the Chinese, who want to be respected in those councils. On the Uyghur issue, we've sanctioned some of the officials responsible for the Uyghur internment and detention, you know, camps, but certainly not enough. There's a lot more to do on sanctioning more individuals in charge of those policies. There's more to do in terms of select targeted visa bans for them and their children, both in the US and hopefully in the West. There's more to do in terms of sanctioning companies, you know, technological companies or banning exports. We have to do it collectively with the rest of the advanced economies that sell equipment to run the Uyghur detention camps and so on. I think there's more to do. So rhetorically, we're now saying the right things, which, you know, particularly Secretary Pompeo is saying that our problem is not with the Chinese people, it's with the Chinese Communist Party. But we're not yet doing enough to demonstrate that. So, for example, I'll just give, you know, there was a humanitarian crisis again in China this summer with massive flooding. And China was, just like the pandemic, wasn't dealing with it very effectively. We could have offered mass humanitarian relief and efforts to those people in China. Now, the Chinese would have rejected it, but everyone would have known that we offered it, and we would have sort of won the Chinese people over to our side. You know, the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in a lot of internal propaganda, how we're the enemies of all Chinese, and that we are trying to keep China down, and you know, doing things that you know, like providing, offering humanitarian relief, you know, offering Hong Kongers, you know, quick visa, you know, refugee status, matter a lot in terms of winning the hearts and minds of the Chinese people.
So we've actually done rather well at that in terms of Iran. And you can see that the Iranian people, whenever they're given the opportunity, speak well of us, which, you know, suggests that the same would be true in China if we differentiate. But as far as international organizations go, you have the UN, you have WHO, increasingly beholden to China and a little bit also to Russia and the UN. Are we better off in or are we better off out?
Well, so on the W, I would take it institution by institution, right? So WHO overall, I guess we're probably better off in, but we should withhold our funding until we get a new leader of the WHO. We need very conditional, you know, we need intensive diplomacy on what we expect from the WHO in China. And we're better off using our leverage to effectuate transparency and change. If we can't get through on the WHO, for example, then we need to create a new organization like the D+10, which is major democracies internationally, which are forming a new organization around principles of technology already. So I would take it case by case. I mean, some institutions, perhaps the Human Rights Council, is hopeless. but some institutions that matter the most to us, I think we should use our considerable leverage to gain change, and change begins with new leadership.
And maybe a role for Taiwan in WHO?
Of course. I mean, that has got to be condition precedent. I mean, it's, you know, Taiwan's role in the pandemic, you know, they probably handled it better than anybody in the world. So it's just pure ugly politics to keep them out of things like the World Health Organization.
So as you know, I like to end programs with a positive note. So I always ask people to give me a question, the answer to which is positive. And I'm going to think about this for a minute. Think of something positive you need to say here. But let me remind our viewers that Dan's book is going to be available, and you can pre-order it on Amazon. Somebody sent me a link. So go to Amazon and pre-order the book. It's a book you need to read. It's information you need to have. Okay. So Dan, here comes the question. As regards China, and I suppose as regards other totalitarian entities, the Soviet Union, when that was our problem, China now, what is the greatest weakness of the United States, and what is our greatest strength as we approach those?
Well, great question. So greatest weakness. So in the short term, our greatest weakness are these divisions. And I don't want to, you know, there's blame to go around everywhere. But countries really look at that and do ask, you know, are they up to it? I mean, can they fashion a durable strategy that will endure through administrations and so forth? You know, I'd say there's structural problems that are worse than that. You know, we've got to fix our debt. You know, we've got social breakdown and, you know, so on. But I think we're wealthy enough that if we had the political will and so on, we could address those problems. In terms of our strength, I mean, you know, there's a reason why even Chinese who don't like the way we're talking about China now want to come here, send their kids here to be students. It's still the American dream for them. There's no country that I know of that can, you know, take even a Chinese immigrant, you know, who studies somewhere and makes them, you know, lets them be extremely successful and American and free anywhere in the world. And they know that. And that's fundamentally why they fear us so much. I mean, that's what they say. You know, they that's why they try to block too much access to us. I mean, there's just this allure of something we have that's special. And it can't be created, you know, it's sort of organic, and you can't really create it elsewhere. So that's a huge strength.
Good. That's where I want to end. So thank you, Dan Blumenthal, for another outstanding presentation. I think we know more. I think we have a better idea of what we need to worry about, and maybe what we need to feel good about. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Remember, The China Nightmare, The Grand Ambitions of a Decaying State by Dan Blumenthal. Order it, read it, enjoy it. And we will be back to you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.